everybody. Welcome into the back room. I'm Andy Ostroy. We're excited to chat with producer and film festival founder Jonathan Burkhart in our live audience podcast taping series. We will chat with Jonathan shortly, but first, thank you for tuning in today. We appreciate you listening, and we'd love to hear your comments. So email us at backroomandy@gmail.com and or post on our social media, and we'll read some feedback next time. And if you like the podcast, please follow or subscribe and rate and review, and you'll be notified every time we post a new episode. So without further ado, let's go to the Morton Library in Rhinecliff, New York, for our live audience chat with Jonathan Burkhart.
Welcome, everyone, to our second live taping of The Backroom with Andy Ostroy with special guest Jonathan Burkhart.
Welcome to The Backroom.
Welcome, Jonathan.
Okay, so this is a little story about Jonathan. At 13, he worked as a camera operator at a TV station on Nantucket Island for its 5:30 p.m. newscast. At 15, he was promoted to news director. After college, he worked as a cameraman for film and TV. His film credits include Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing and Mo Better Blues, Mountain View for John Sayles, A Better Tomorrow for John Woo, and Dazed and Confused for Richard Linklater. He later produced independent films, television, and theater, including the award-winning Baby Steps, Higher Ground, Peace, Love, and Misunderstanding, The Last Keepers, Rhymes with Banana, and most recently, Antarctica. His TV projects include Almost There, Ivy Dreams, Must Do Disney, The Super Bowl Halftime Show, Away We Go with Jonathan Larson, and The Tomorrow Is Tonight Show starring Ben Stiller. He's also produced commercials for Ford, Disney, Chase, and American Express. In theater, Jonathan produced the Tony-nominated Broadway production of Mario Cantone's Laugh Whore, the award-winning play Avow, and the 10th anniversary original cast production of Rent. He is also co-founder of the Nantucket Film Festival and is event producer for Project ALS, the organization launched by his friend Jennifer Estes, who died from the disease in 2003.
Whew! That's a lot.
All right, so
if I only ever got paid for that stuff.
I want to start with this prepubescent news career.
Yeah.
Okay. In Nantucket. How'd that happen?
Well, there was this experiment. So literally there was an experiment with the FCC putting a tower in Cape Cod and a tower in Nantucket to test signal strength in like 1974 or 75. And it lasted a couple of years. And what I understand is that when it was over, the FCC left it there and this local family bought it. And the transmitter was in my dad's closet. My dad was the art teacher. My dad was the art teacher at the Nantucket High School. And I remember one day going there and there was a bunch of guys sitting around it and they were like, yeah, we're going to start a TV station. And that's from there. I remember a guy named Flip O'Connell doing interviews on the street on Main Street. Nantucket's this big. And all I remember was he said, can you help me carry these cases back into the van? And from that, it was into the studio. And it was a studio in a basement of a building in the middle of town. And it just evolved from there to, by the time I graduated high school, it was a full-blown TV station with studios, editing rooms, and a documentary department. And I was doing news and sports. And, you know, for all those years, it was me and four or five other people. But I did it every day after school. I did it in the summer times. And I learned how to shoot, edit, direct the news. Mind you, it was small, but it actually meant something. And by the time I got to college and left college and went to professionals, I realized what I had learned were the mechanics of how you make it in the film and TV business.
But you were 13.
I had
that's
nothing.
Where I was going.
Well, you know, so
how did that happen?
Well, so I have a twin brother.
It's like in between your bar mitzvah lessons or something.
No,
you ran
so
over
I have a twin brother who one day came home from school in fifth grade with a pair of drumsticks. That's in fifth grade. Today, he's still a drummer. My sister Jill was always in the theater community and always involved in films and whatnot. And so watching them, I was like, yeah, I can do this too. And so we just did it. Everybody was like making stuff happen on that tiny spit of sand in the Atlantic Ocean.
So what were you like as a kid before you embarked on this successful teenage career in broadcast journalism?
I was fucking 10, 11, 12. I had nothing when you're a kid. I was on Nantucket. I didn't know anything different. I didn't have anything. So when I'm 13...
That's a weird answer for a kid who was like a news director at 14.
No. What you have to understand is that this was an awakening. When I got involved with the TV station and it became a thing, and I actually started getting paid
right.
every single day after school and on the weekends, we were shooting the Nantucket High School football team, or we'd go off island for this, or there was the March of Dimes telethon that we would do every July. Mm-hmm. And so it just became this thing we did all the time. And I had a job. And it was great. There were cameras and sound and lights and a studio, and we'd shoot out in the streets. And mm-hmm. I will tell you an amazing thing. We used to leave the island to go do certain things. I'll never forget, because of the March of Dimes telethon, in 1978 or so, a bunch of the guys like, yeah, man, can you meet us in Connecticut in a few weeks? We're going to go shoot a basketball game in Hartford. And I remember getting up like 3-4 o'clock in the morning, taking like a 6 o'clock ferry, take a bus down to Connecticut. Anyway, I did that a bunch of times with this family, the Rasmussen family in Connecticut, who created a thing called ESPN. It was literally the family.
I don't know.
It's this sports thing. They have games on it and stuff. But it literally was the father and the son were building ESPN, and they were doing hockey and basketball, and a bunch of people from the Boston, Rhode Island area would go down, and I was just the kid like, oh, yeah, carry cases. And I'd operate one of the cameras during basketball.
And they asked you to be the CEO, probably.
No, I just knew after a while, I was like, oh, it became something. It was mm-hmm. worth it. But mm-hmm. I just, we'd get there at like 5 o'clock in the morning with a mountain full of cables. You have to load it into a school, and said, oh, it was a lot of work.
So to sort of like set the stage here for that period of your life, you're a 15-year-old boy. You are running a newsroom. You're going to school.
Yeah. Failing.
And like whacking off 10 times a day. That's a full plate. Talk to me about your time management back then.
If I knew how to whack off back then, Andy.
Okay, so I want to know how you got to Nantucket. Tell me about how you got to Nantucket, the family.
And I thought this was going to be real. How we got to Nantucket? Mom and Dad went there for their honeymoon in 1956.
Uh-huh.
And something happened where we were living in New York, and all I knew is one day Mom and Dad said, we're moving to Nantucket. I think we'd gone there a couple of times in the summertime prior mm-hmm. to that. But Dad got a job as a teacher of the art department at the Nantucket High School. Mm-hmm. And we moved in like 70 or 71, and we lived there. Oh. You know what I do remember was we landed on Nantucket, and me, Seth, and Jill were sitting up in this house. And I remember my brother Seth and I walking through this field, ended up at this beach. And we realized that we could get to the beach from the house. And the house had gotten smaller and smaller, but it was like, there's a beach. We can go to the beach. And that was cool.
All right.
That's what I remember.
So you were happy with the move, or you?
Yeah, all right, yeah, okay. It's good. I mean, listen, it's, you know, Nantucket, I still
Sounds
consider
like a
my
place
home.
To grow up.
It was great. I mean, I wish we could still go, but
especially if you want to be in the news business.
All the billionaires live there now, and mm-hmm. it's not affordable to be there. So,
mm-hmm, right.
But it's gorgeous.
So you've clearly, over your career, the early part of your career, you gravitated towards the equipment, the technological side of things. Was that a part of your childhood? Were you a kid in a room playing
yeah.
with gadgets?
Oh, I love the camera.
Like
to this day, I love the camera. Mm-hmm. Like when I work on movies today, if I can be the B camera operator or second unit DP, I do it. I love photography. I love composition and lighting. Still today, it's great. Mm-hmm.
How much of that do you do in your career now versus producing?
So when I'm producing a movie, depending on how big the budget and what the union ramifications are, if I can operate the camera, I do. But if I can't, this is me on set. What kind of camera is that? Because I used to shoot film. It was all 35mm film. And then 25, 30 years ago, well, it became digital.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about something interesting, which is the advances in the technology over the years. Like, how much is it different than 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
Well, the difference literally is film. There's no celluloid. You know, when we shot a movie, you put a 1,000-foot mag on a camera, which mm-hmm. is roughly 10 minutes. And I have an entire department of people loading film into magazines. And when I run out, I let the ADs know, camera, you know, reloading.
Right.
And so today, that doesn't exist. I put a card into the camera right. that shoots for 4 hours.
Right. But even within the digital world, there's so much change.
Yeah. I had a shoot yesterday in New York City, and I'm shooting in a medical laboratory. And one scene I'm doing with light coming through a window, and it was great. But then I have to go into this other one with all this technical equipment with no light at all. And the camera on its own just adapted to no light. I'm like, I don't fucking need any. It's like wild. It's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, the technology is wild. And that's the other thing, too, is that in the 35mm days, there was the on and off switch, and that was it. Today, you see these assistants. There's a screen coming up on the side of the camera, and they're hitting buttons after buttons and window after window of, like, iris settings and this and that set. I'm like, oh, it's...
Do you like that part of it, or do you...
No, I don't. It's still about the lens and the light. What's in the frame.
Right.
Which is, I mean, if I may, one of the things I've loved and I learned was composition. Dad always said when we were kids, you got to look at art before electricity was invented and look at how painters would compose a scene and look at where the light's coming from, the sun or something bouncing off the wall. And still to this day, I look at that because there was no electricity where there was a light that would illuminate this or that. So when we shoot a movie today, and even though I'm a producer, what I look for is what are we doing to tell a story? No matter what the movie is, it could be a $200 million with Spielberg or a $500,000 thing with some kid out of NYU. It's always a camera. And the art of storytelling is what's going to happen in the frame and what the people are doing, speaking, moving, whatever it is. But it's the illumination. And that causes emotion. It causes you to feel what you're seeing. And that's there's art in that. Mm-hmm. It takes time to learn that shit. People fuck it up all the time, but did that answer your question?
It did. Let's park ourselves in college for a minute.
Oh, God.
You have a pretty fascinating story, a pretty fascinating relationship with the genius composer Jonathan Larson.
Oh, yeah.
And your relationship to the musical that he created.
Rent.
Talk a little bit about that.
I met Jonathan Larson in the summer of '84 in Nantucket. For the first time, I'd gone back and I had no place to live. I was working at the Opera House restaurant as a waiter, and somebody said to me, there's a piano player at the next restaurant. He's looking for a place to live too. You should connect with him. So I go over and there's this guy, Jonathan, and we hooked up and decided we'd hunt for a place to stay, found a house, became roommates. And by the end of that summer, I dropped out of college and I wasn't sure if I was going to go back to, I didn't know what to do. And he said, just move into my apartment in New York City. Come live with me. And I moved in September of '84. We were roommates for several years. He was, you know, cranking out music and trying to write musicals and whatnot. And I was navigating my career and trying to figure out what was going on.
So Rent was not a part of that period?
Not even close. No, Rent came years and years and years later. He was working on other musicals. Rent came to him in 1992. Mm-hmm. And wrote and wrote and wrote. And, you know, he spent years and years and years writing other musicals, trying to get productions, money, this or that. And nothing happened. And then Rent was the one thing that set with the New York Theater Workshop. He'd gotten a grant from this organization, got him some exposure. Artistic director, a guy named James Nicola, recognized it and said, let's do this. And it happened.
And you remained tight with him throughout that period.
We were best friends.
Leading up to that.
Yeah, we were roommates. We hung out. We'd go traveling together all the time.
How much of like his early iterations or the creative process for Rent were you a part of? Or did he show you stuff, listen to stuff?
All the time. I mean, so one of the most fucked up things, I don't know if you guys know Rent, but earlier drafts, there's a significant story between Mark and Roger where Mark's girlfriend leaves him for another woman. So in real life, several years before he made Rent, Jonathan had a girlfriend for years. And one day when she was in the shower, he lost a sock under the bed and he found a diary and he opened up and long story short, he realized that she was two-timing him, that she had a full-time girlfriend. She was a lesbian and he just completely freaked out. A couple years go by. I was with a woman where one day she woke up, she's like, I'm in love with so-and-so and with another woman and the relationship was over. So he's writing Rent, and at one point, as he's writing drafts of it between Mark and Roger, which is really more Jonathan, the guitar player, I'm not sure if you guys know the show, loses his girlfriend to another woman. One day, we were driving back from, I think we'd gone to the beach or something, Long Island, and he's dropping me off in the West Village, and he goes, oh, by the way, I rewrote the character where now Mark, his girlfriend leaves him for another woman, knowing that people would say, oh, that's Burkhart. I was like, fuck, are you serious, man? Really?
What is it with you guys and women?
So
you're like George from Seinfeld.
So, you know, it's interesting. Well, when you're in your 20s, you know, and you're trying to get a career, you're also trying to date and, you know, kiss somebody and get involved in a relationship. Because he played the piano. Anytime we went out, if there was a piano or keyboard, he'd start to play. Women would just hover around him. And I'd be the guy off to the side going,
of course he was in a lesbian bar when he did this. Boom.
Well, we'd be out and he'd have all these women. And I'd be like, hey, how's it going? And I was always like the straggler trying to talk to the woman that wasn't close enough to him in the piano.
Right.
Didn't always work.
So when you would hear the initial iterations, did you?
I didn't know shit. I didn't connect. I
mean, so it didn't hit you like, oh my God, this is a classic.
He wrote a musical called Superbia, which is a futuristic thing where all the characters that he created were people we knew. And then from there, he created a thing called Tick, Tick, Boom, that were everybody we know. And then when he went into Rent, it was basically all the storylines of the people we know. The AIDS epidemic had exploded, and we knew a lot of people that had been diagnosed and were dying. And then the strangest thing was that people, men and women who were heterosexual, were being diagnosed and dying, which changed a lot. And living in the West Village during these years, we'd step outside of our house and there was always this air of like, oh my God, is everybody okay? And the world didn't, I mean, the world perceived AIDS in a different way, but in the West Village, it was more of this intense thing. And so this is the sad part, is that he died the night of the dress rehearsal from an undiagnosed aortic aneurysm. That day he died was opening night at the New York Theater Workshop, heavy duty. Months go by, it moves to Broadway. And as time ticked on and I'm hearing the show, I'm like, holy fuck. I mean, I had heard bits and pieces all along, but I never, you know what I think I've perceived is that he purposely kept me away from the last several months of development. He used to say, so for all the shows he had written, I would always go to all the rehearsals and the performances, and I'd help, you know, set up the microphones and this. That. He kept me away from Rent. He'd always say, no, you can't do it yet. Don't come yet. And the dress rehearsal, he said I couldn't go.
Was that because he just held on to it? Because he felt it wasn't ready yet for...
I don't know. I couldn't. He died. I couldn't ask him. But my guess is that he... I have this sense that he didn't want me to hear it. Because it's... I see in the story, it's a lot about me and him.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Fuck.
Do you know at what stage of the production was he at when he died?
Well, it was finished. This is the bizarre part. A couple of days after he died, I got a phone call from the director and the artistic director of the New York Theater Workshop. I said, can you come in and talk to Tim Wilde, the musical director? And I go to Tim, and there's the band and the cast, and he says, we have a bunch of questions. We don't have Jonathan here to answer. What did he mean by this? What do you mean? I'm like, what the fuck do I know? I mean, the storyline went a certain way. So I contributed what I could, but this guy, Tim Wilde, who's a musical director, who's a brilliant human being, really had to take control of the... I don't know if you guys know how a Broadway musical is created, but once it's written and it's finally on stage with a cast and a band or an orchestra and the lights in the set, the writer, the creator, will compose and tweak the story and the music and the blocking and how somebody hits a note to make sure it jives. Because you're creating in your living room or on a keyboard or something, right. But by the time it's up on stage and it's built, getting it to its place for performance for an audience, you're tweaking it left and right. And he wasn't there for that. So there was a lot of tweaking, and this guy, Tim Wilde, handled that. And I contributed what I could.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift to Spike Lee. You worked with Spike Lee on Do the Right Thing.
Yeah.
And you were a camera operator for that.
I started as a focus puller, as a first assistant cameraman.
And when you were working on that film, because now it's an iconic, classic film, did you have a sense of any of that when you were working on it?
Of all the films I'd worked on, it was the wildest, fucked up mess. It was like, what the? Every day we'd get on set and Spike would say, no, put the camera over there and shoot this. And the ADs would be like, dude, that's not in the script. We got to go. And we would just shoot. He would ad lib things. And I remember it was like a 3-month shoot schedule in the summer of 1988. And I remember thinking, this is never going to cut together. I don't know what the fuck we did. Because just Radio Raheem with the rings on his finger or any of the other characters. It was a wild, wild mess. And I remember about 8 months later, there was a screening of a rough cut that ran 4 hours long. And I remember sitting with Ernest Dickerson, the cinematographer, and Spike and some other people. John Killick was a famous producer. And he's like, we have to cut this down. We got to cut this. And the movie, he did end up cutting it, but it was just a wild mess. But then again, you watch the final piece and then you realize where it goes to and what it's done today. It's like, that is a perfect example of you cannot question the cinematic process of telling a story. I've worked on dozens and dozens of movies for decades, and I'm with the director who's saying, blah, 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 let's do this. And I'm like, how the fuck is that going to cut together? How is the story? Is that going to work? But you don't know. Because there's this artistic vision of how you do things and bring the story to life, and the actors say the lines, or the camera goes like this, whatever it is, and then it cuts together. And I've worked on plenty of movies that are unwatchable, and I've worked in lots of movies like, oh my God, that is fucking brilliant. How did it get to be that way?
What was it about him in particular, you think, as a director? Because he kind of like just burst out of nowhere. What made him special? And what do you think made that film special? Was it just of the era, the racial tension in New York City?
You know,
Blackout?
I'll say what was interesting, unlike any other movie I've worked on, Do the Right Thing was shot on one block in Bed-Stuy. In that the way it was built was he got permission from the city of Brooklyn and this neighborhood where this one particular street deep into Bed-Stuy had the vast majority. As a matter of fact, I think of all the brownstones and buildings, 95% were empty and had been shelled out. It was a really bad part of Bed-Stuy. It was in bad shape. And Spike took over the street and he wrote the story that evolved entirely on that street. And so we parked all the trucks in a different area and catering was a block away and hair and makeup was over there and the production office was in. And so for 3 months of shooting, we were on this street. And every day, all the actors were there. Every actor was on set and all the background actors. And it became more of like a family and more like a thing because we'd eat breakfast, we'd shoot for a bunch of hours, we'd eat lunch, we'd shoot for a bunch of hours, and then we'd come back the next day. And so I think week after week after week, that built, unlike any other movies I worked on, it built this environment where we just did things. And that was the rare part because I think the actors had more time to work on their characters. You know, when you make a movie, no matter what you're doing, one day you're over there, mm-hmm. and then the next day you're over there, and then next day you're 3 miles that way, or you're in another state, and it's just you're racing to get the day done. So this particular project was in this one block, and I think that had a lot to do with building character and whatnot, because we just cranked it out.
Mm-hmm. And the acting in that film was amazing. It's kind of hard to imagine that film without Danny Aiello and John Turturro.
And do you know what I learned? I remember hanging out. He had only done a couple of things prior to that, and he got an Oscar nomination for that role. And I remember talking to him, and prior to being an actor, he was a plumber or a carpenter or something. Mm-hmm. And he didn't start acting until his mid-40s.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And this was his first time ever with a proper, call it a leading role. And his sons were on set. His sons were the stunt doubles. And it was wild. It was crazy.
When did you decide and why did you decide to put the camera down for the most part and become a producer?
I don't think I decided. I think it was rent had exploded. And when Jonathan died, his dad said to me, stay with the show. Do nothing but stay with the show. And literally the day it opened at the New York Theater Workshop, it exploded. 2 months later, we moved it to Broadway. It exploded even bigger. Won the Pulitzer, won all the Tony Awards.
What did that mean, stay with the show, in terms of your
role? I didn't fucking
role.
Know. I had no idea, but it was manage it. And even though there are producers there, and actually the two main producers were in their 20s, they had never done anything before, much of anything, and they're now hugely famous and very rich. Mm-hmm. There was this environment of... All of Jonathan's work had to be managed and all of Jonathan's money had to be managed. And so Jonathan was the book writer, the lyricist, and the composer. So he got three paychecks a week plus profit sharing. It's called rent for we couldn't pay our rent. And the show made billions of dollars. And so there's a lot of money management. The other part too was that there was a lot of dealing with all of his work that was now being asked for. Soon thereafter, Tick, Tick, Boom finally got produced. But staying with rent, a lot of it had to do with, you know what my job was? A lot of it was they started the first road company, the first U.S. tour. Mm-hmm. And adapting a Broadway show to sit in trucks to move from city to city slightly changes. And they would say, listen to it. Is this going to work on the road? Or when Luciano Pavarotti bought the rights to do it in Italy, and they had me listen to the translation there. Did it make sense? Is it still the same thing? The weirdest one was when I flew to Seoul, South Korea to listen to Rent. And they had sent me the script that was translated from English into Korean back to English. And I'm reading it. I'm going, that's not the story. Wait, what? And then I hear them sing on stage in their Korean language with the orchestra. I'm like, kind of sounds like, okay. go. It's like, what the fuck, you know? But like in Italian, it worked. And in French, when it played in, when it opened in Germany, Jonathan's mother, Nan, was like, we're not going to Germany. Those fucking Nazis, we're not doing this. I was like, Burkhardt, go to Germany and make sure this thing works. Holy fuck.
Nazis.
Yeah. Okay. It still rings true today. A lot of people have a problem with that. You know what I mean?
You've worked with a lot of truly amazing people.
Yeah.
Okay. Ben Stiller, John Woo, Sales. Do you have a favorite? And if so, why?
I don't. And you're asking me now that I'm decades into it, and I can tell you that I'm really tired of doing this. But what prevails for me of the things that I like are the people who are clear and articulate. Mm-hmm. So I've worked on dozens and dozens of movies where there's money, and there's another producer, and there's a director, and this and that. And over the years, it's like, it's freelance. It's just another job. So in the early days, it's like, we're making a movie. We're telling a story. We're all here. Yay, Hollywood. And that lasts to a point. Then you realize it's just another fucking job. And that the entire crew, this is the big thing.
You sound jaded.
Well, hold no, but here's the reality that a lot of people don't understand about
Hollywood. Conversation's taking a turn.
Well, the reality is it's a freelance industry. And you get into a movie and you have a 100-person crew. Like, we're making this movie, and the director's really passionate, and the producer, and we're really, and the cast is like absorb the characters, and we're going to shoot the story and bring it to life, and there's all this energy, mm-hmm. and that crew's like, yeah, man, we're here. That fucking crew doesn't care. They were just on a movie 3 weeks ago. It's another paycheck. Your art department, hair and makeup, camera, grip, electric, sound, wardrobe. It's now, I don't mean to say they don't care. They do. But you do this for a few decades, and you get, and you realize that crew that shows up, they want a director to speak clearly, this is what we're doing. They don't give a shit. Comedy, horror film, coming to age, whatever it is. All they want every day is clarity and that fucking paycheck every Friday.
So what you're saying is they want a director to direct.
Well, but it's not just that. So this is what I would say is that if you ask me what I enjoyed, I produced a movie called Antarctica with a guy named Keith Bearden. This guy came to work every day with what plan A was, but he had plans B and C ready to go. Mm-hmm. And he was nice. And I've only worked with, Katie, I did Dazed and Confused with it, Katie Kokonos. I did a movie with her called I Dream Too Much. Katie was brilliant. Uh-huh. Every day, this is what we're doing. If we couldn't do that, here's plan B. So the beauty of getting through the day and shooting an entire movie over the course of month after month is knowing how this is going to operate and that communication. And I think this is applicable to any type of industry, any
sure.
type of job.
But isn't that like just a vision thing?
Yeah, but still, I've worked with directors that are hugely famous that can barely put together a sentence. Put the camera over there.
Name names.
Well, you know, I was on set. I'll never forget this one. A buddy of mine was running the locations department for a Woody Allen movie. And I was invited to hang out for a bunch of days in a row. The cinematographer was Sven Nykvist. You guys know who Sven is? Sven is one of the greatest cinematographers. And this is like, I studied his lighting all the time. And he's now in his like mid to late 80s, and he's leaning against a wall every time he lifts up. But there's Woody Allen, and I'm watching him direct, and he didn't say shit day after day after day. And I would ask people, saying, why isn't he talking? He's like, he doesn't talk to the cast. They read the script. He'll call action. If he doesn't like the take, he might say, can you just walk in a little faster? And that was it. Now, I'm sure that Woody Allen has a lot more directorial skills, but what I witnessed was very little communication. And I heard people say he doesn't talk a whole lot in set. Mm. But, you know, Richard Linklater, when we shot, what was the movie? Dazed and Confused. Mm-hmm. He has a habit. He'll cast his movie, and he works with his cast weeks in advance, rehearsing over and over again. Mm-hmm. He wants them to understand the story and get those characters.
Yeah, well, you said it before. It's like any business, any endeavor, you know, there are going to be people who do things differently, and yeah. some things are better, and some people do it better than others, right?
Right.
I mean, the movie business is no different. What are the major ways, aside from the cameras that we were talking about before, technology. How has the film business changed, in your opinion, since your days like working with Spike?
Hollywood studios, I don't think, are as powerful as they used to be. The streaming services have come in, and even though they're tied to the studios in a particular way, that Paramount, Warner Brothers, Universal, Fox, Sony, I'm missing somebody, where they owned hundreds and hundreds of acres of land. Like, if you ever go to the Warner Brothers lot, it's massive and intimidating. And they have studios and production offices and whatnot. And then that's where they make a lot of movies. And they did, whatever happened in the 30s to the 50s and 60s and 70s. But today, it's not the same. The world of independent film has, I think, really become very powerful. Like, when I did Days and Confused in Austin, Texas, Austin exploded with movies. Just so many independents. Atlanta, Georgia exploded. That was one of the things I learned a bunch of years ago, was where all the work was. Buffalo, New York, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Atlanta. It's like, what the fuck are people doing in Buffalo? But there's amazing studios. Plus, there's a New York State Film Tax Credit, which encourages people.
Georgia's the same. With
right,
the tax
yeah.
Credit.
Louisiana. Ohio has an amazing film tax credit, but there's no crew and equipment. But you can get a lot of money back. But the change is, I think it's more of an independent world. And
distribution, right? It's easier to distribute it, but is it harder to get the funding these days to make an independent film? Because
the world of funding is, it's like fishing. You just don't know what's out there. You know, you don't know if you're going to get money from a private individual, right, a group of people, a studio, some distributor that does distribute films, but they're not tied to the studio side of things or the studio itself. There's a million different ways that people get money. And it's generally piecemeal. Like, there was a time when you'd go to the movies years and years ago and you'd watch and the lights would go out and the movie would start and you'd see the title of the production company. It might be one or two. Now you watch a movie that's like 15 production companies that finance it or are involved. And it's like, oh, they all each gave $500,000 and, you know, that's how it's done. It's a mystery. And it's a never-ending process, which there was a time when I got a phone call. I had a lawyer in New York City, a guy named Tom Sells, who called me one day in like 2002, 2003, and he goes, you got to get into finance. You know so many rich people. And this is my lawyer. And he sat me down and he walked me through several days of education of how finances work legally. Tax credits, tax code, loss and depreciation. He says, you need to ask all these rich people for money. And so I went down this path and I played this game for a while and I was involved in raising some money. And I have been around people who were very successful to raise large film funds, the tunes of hundreds of millions, if not many tens of millions of dollars. And it's this fucking process, beating the pavement, pitching this story and pitching that story. This is going to sell. The audience is going to love that. After I was like, no, I'm just going to physically make the movie. I'd much rather hire the crew, work with the director, work with the key creatives, art department and wardrobe and camera, and figure out how do we bring this movie to life each day. I'd rather be that producer, except that the hours are much longer.
Mm-hmm. So in 1996, you and your sister Jill decided to create the Nantucket Film Festival.
Yeah.
By the way, Jill is in the audience tonight. This is her birthday today.
Holy shit.
Do you want to...
Actually, my sister Jill, she's here.
Do you want to lead everybody in a little happy birthday?
Yeah, it's my sister's birthday. Ready?
Happy birthday to you.
Jill. Happy birthday to you. No, you're just supposed to be nice and go, yay!
Happy birthday, dear Jill.
Happy birthday to you.
Woo! All right. So you start this film festival.
Well, I think it's important to note, going back to Larson, is that it was Jonathan and I.
You just want to cry again, don't you?
No. It was Jonathan and I in October of 1994 went to Nantucket to just march around and hang out. And in this one particular day, just cruising through the island, we ran to like four different people between New York and LA. Just strangely, we're like, dude, man, I just made a film. You got to see it. And at the end of the day, we're like, everybody's making film. You know what? We should come back here this time next year with all of our friends and show all the movies and we'll get a keg of beer and we'll talk about filmmaking, show each other's work. Let's do a film festival. And Larson said, and it has to be a screenwriter. It has to be all about the screenwriters and the writing process. And so we came up with this idea of the Nantucket Film Festival, which at the time he was getting into this heavy rehearsal. No, this is 94. Rent really got going in 95. And the idea was that Rent was going to play 3 weeks at the New York Theater Workshop and close like in the beginning of March. And then he and I were going to go full blown into launching this film festival idea. He dies. And I remember, I can't remember where the conversation was. I said, Jill, nah. But Jill immediately jumped in. And the two of us that winter and spring of 96 pulled it together and launched it.
Yeah. And it's almost 30 years old.
Yeah. It's a 29th
year. It's kind of crazy. And I've attended several times.
Well, can I say one of the more significant things? So we launched it, and I'll never forget, we finished the first one. We come back to New York, it's like July or August of 96. And I was like, I ain't fucking doing this again. And I remember I had to go to this office somewhere in Midtown where this woman was running this filmmakers collaborative, whatever it was. And I walk in and she goes, congratulations, your film festival. Cause we got a lot of press and it went really well. And I was like, I ain't fucking doing that again. That was too much work. And she goes, that's fine. You can leave. It's going to go on without you. And I'm like, what? And I go back to the office and there was a message on the machine from some sponsors like, we're coming back for Double the Money. It's like, okay, we're doing it again. But here's the most bizarre thing that really fucks me up. Later that year of 96, I don't know if it was a phone call or an email or knock on the door, but this woman, Mistel Brabe, comes in and introduces herself. And she says, oh, I want to work with you guys. That was the summer of 96. To this day, she's still with the film festival. She mm-hmm. runs it. She has for decades. It's the craziest thing in the world because I feel this guilt like, it was an idea, man, to show movies. And it's this nonprofit that runs, and she runs it perfectly. And it keeps going and going and going. I'm like, okay, we're going to do it. We had our 10th anniversary. I'm like, yeah, we can shut it down. Nope, 15 years in, then 20 years in, and now we're about to be 30, and it keeps going. It's wild. And one of the greatest things I will say from my whole experience was now there's this thing where we get to see brand new work. I get to see brand new work. Here's the other thing I'll share with you. I remember the first 2 years that Jill and I ran it, I was involved in screening and making decisions. No, I can't do that. That's way too hard. The work of taking in hundreds and hundreds of submissions, watching all these movies and trying to decide what the lineup is based on story and this and that, that's a huge talent that I don't have. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can watch a movie once in a while and then go home and go to sleep, but as a job, to have to watch hundreds of movies and make a decision about what an audience might see of a brand new piece of work that no one's ever seen before. Fuck. It's really hard. But Mistel does it all the time. My sister did it for years and years. My sister still works in this industry today where she produces tons of shows and she has to watch cut after cut. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that spinal fluid is dripping out of your ear eventually. Like, I can't keep doing this.
You like to kvetch, don't you?
I thought that's what you taught me to kvetch. Oy.
The film festival world these days is different than it was. When like you go to Sundance and there'd be like a bidding war. Yeah. And how essential today in getting a distribution deal, given the landscape with streamers and such, how essential is the film festival? I know in Nantucket's a little bit different in the sense that it's attended by people who really love film. And it's not so much about deal-making as it is just experiencing the joy of film. But overall, in terms of film festivals, how significant today are they compared to just
It's a really, really difficult question. But here's what my gut says. So the entire landscape mm-hmm. of filmmaking has just changed over the last 5 to 7 years.
Right.
And that independent world has gotten much stronger. Again, studios are not making as much as they used to, but more specifically, the art of premiering at, say, a Sundance or a Toronto or a Cannes and getting a distribution deal, those are the bigger markets, and those things still do happen. I'm going to go out on a limb here, and what I see and feel is that I think it's shrinking to a certain degree, that there's not as much of that going on because of the streaming services that are buying stuff in advance. It's just the whole world of that process of getting financed, making a movie, selling it into distribution. And when I say selling into distribution, we can sell a movie into distribution in the United States or North America, but the European deal or Great Britain or France or Italy or South America or Australia may not have been done yet. So there are these components to get your film out in the world territory to territory. It's very different. It's done a lot more independently now. My gut is that it's getting smaller, and I don't know what the future of film festivals are, and I don't know what the future is of getting a film out into distribution because these streaming services are just changing mm-hmm. the process. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's be honest with each other. Very, very few people go to the movies anymore.
That is true.
The cineplexes around the world have just shut down and filed for bankruptcy. People just don't go out because everybody's got a flat screen TV and the internet, and they watch what's on Amazon or Hulu or Apple or Netflix.
Right.
And it's just a bizarre world, and they're the buyers.
And plus, it seems like the studios are using the festivals these days more to premiere their
bigger films. That's been happening.
My last question to you. So you produce for film, you produce for TV, you produce commercials.
Yeah.
What is the difference to you in those three disciplines? And do you have a favorite? Is there something that just attracts you more to one medium versus another?
I think over the years, as I've gotten tired of the whole process, I've been able to, through therapy, recognize what I do like about it. And I've become, you're laughing, but it's the truth. I mean, let's be blunt.
We're back to the kvetching, aren't we?
Well, you know, so there's this thing. It's the drive of you got to pay the bills. And it's right. A freelance industry. And you're only as good as the next phone call. Yeah, we got the money. Are you available? Okay, let's go. Year after year after year, you do that. And then, so I go for the money at times. I mean, I have a saying where people say, oh, what kind of movies do you make? Do you like horror comedies? And I'm always like, if I had to decide what movie I produce based on the quality of the script, I'd be homeless in the street. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what's good. If I see the money and I see light at the end of the tunnel and it's all organized, that's the movie I make. That's really what it comes down to. I can't say, I just do comedies. I can't.
Don't you like need a trust fund to do that? Like being able to do whatever you want and not have to worry about money. Like when someone says, hey, I got to follow the money because I got bills to pay. Like,
right.
That's how the world works, right?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and yeah, so it's this freelance game of just taking the next job. Mm-hmm. I've worked on plenty of movies that I'm like, here's a story, if I may. I just produced a movie last year where I got the script in January of 23. It was financed and I read it and it was a horror film. And everybody dies in it. There's a lot of stabbing and blood and fine. It's a horror film, but it's fully financed, union, the whole thing's organized. And about a few days into production, I go to set to see what's going on. And it's a scene shot in the woods, not too far from here. And I arrive in the middle of a take and the cats are screaming and yelling and screaming. Director calls cut and the entire company of like 75 crew starts laughing hysterically. I was like, why are they laughing? AD goes back to one, we're going again, roll camera, director calls action, this horrible scene of screaming and yelling and crying, director calls cut, the entire company is laughing even harder. And I turn to this woman, I go, why is everybody laughing? This is a horror film. She goes, this is the funniest comedy I've ever made. This is the best film. And I'm like, it's a horror film. It's a horror film. Everybody dies and then there's blood everywhere, but it's really funny. I didn't get it. You know, I'm reading black ink on a white page going, okay, this, you know, any script you're reading, any movie you make, you're reading the script and I'm trying to interpret when they fall in love, what the foreshadowing is. Here's the climax. Here's the end. You know, we're making this, here's the story. Generally, I get it. But until I'll go see a rough cut of a movie and I'm sitting going, oh, right. Oh, that's what happens. Because you never know exactly until it cuts together and you watch that final cut how it is.
All right. Anything in closing that you want to plug shamelessly or other?
I love my wife, Isabel.
What are you working on now? What's that?
I love my wife, Isabel.
Oh, yeah. Look at that.
The 29th Nantucket Film Festival goes up in June.
Mm-hmm.
Yay. I'm working on a concert right now. Which is going to go up in September in New York, which I learned is going to involve some really big, big famous people.
Cool.
That'll be great.
All right.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thanks for chatting.
Thank you.
I think we're done.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you.
This episode of The Back Room was edited and produced by me, Andy Ostroy. It was co-edited and co-produced by Maddie Rosenberg. And co-produced by Jen Hamoud. Our theme song was composed by Andrew Hollander, and our logo was designed by Cricket Langell. And special thanks to Patricia Wind. Please take a moment to rate and review the podcast, and also follow or subscribe. Until next time, keep your eyes on Washington, Hollywood, and your own backyards, and have a great week.